Donald Regan had been targeted by Free the Eagles founder Neil Blair because they moved in the same conservative circles. I would buttonhole him in person at dinners or White House receptions and ask, "Why are you keeping a son of a bitch like McMahon over at the CIA?" Blair was brutally frank about his methods of persuasion. "If you want to know where our strengths came from, we raised and gave funds in the primary and general elections to key Republican senators, and when the Republicans took the Senate in 1982, they took over key committees and subcommittees, and they were beholden to us. And when they came to power, they opened doors for us. They kicked ass for us. They'd call George Shultz and chew him out. They'd call CIA people over and hold their feet to the fire on issues like Afghanistan. And that's how our influence began, and everything spread from there." At its height, the campaign became so intense that every time Regan attended a fundraiser, someone from Free the Eagle would leap out of the crowd demanding to know when the White House was going to deal with the saboteur. The CIA higher-ups simply didn't know what to do. One of the problems was that it was supposed to be a secret operation. As a matter of policy, agents don't discuss covert operations, and even if they had decided to try to defend themselves, the agency wouldn't have dared advertise what it was, in fact, doing in Afghanistan. How could it possibly explain that it was now riding the tiger of militant Islam, fully committed to the single biggest and most ruthless secret war in its history? In reality, the CIA had given its liberal democratic critics just about every conceivable ground agreement to go on the attack, and to question whether such a runaway operation, gargantuan in its size and ruthlessness, made sense. But not a peep had been heard from the left. It should be acknowledged that McMahon was in fact a voice of caution in Bill Casey's CIA, alarmed at the Contra excesses, furious at some of the Iran dealings, and always worried that the Afghan war might precipitate a Russian invasion of Pakistan. But those concerns were hardly unreasonable. What must have seemed most unfair to the deputy director was that although he'd initially insisted on banning sniper rifles and had fought the introduction of American weapons like the Stinger, he had nevertheless been a key element in making the unprecedented escalation possible. And Avrakatos, the ultimate rule-breaker, always saw him as a critical ally. In late 1985 and early 1986, it was preposterous to accuse McMahon or anyone at the CIA of lacking in courage or resolve when it came to providing meaningful support to the Afghans. But McMahon had no choice but to keep silent. "Technically, we weren't supposed to be supporting the Afghans at all, so there was no way I could defend myself or the agency," he says. Ed Jinowitz, then number two man in the Directorate of Operations, maintains that Free the Eagles' campaign, quickly picked up by congressional conservatives like Senator Malcolm Wallop of the Intelligence Committee, ultimately contributed to McMahon's resignation. "Most of us shrugged the attacks off, but they had a tremendous impact on John. He felt they were definitely out to get him. It was a hell of a thing to happen to the deputy director of the agency, Casey's right-hand man." While AEVA and Free the Eagle were moving on the low road, Pillsbury says that Canestraro, sounding much like a cultural anthropologist explaining the conduct of an insular and paranoid tribe, was doing a good job of portraying the agency in an equally dark light. He would invariably begin by describing McMahon as a very nice man who, unfortunately, had been traumatized by the intelligence scandals of the 1970s. Canestraro explained that ever since then, McMahon had done his best to keep the agency out of covert operations that might get them in trouble. That's why he was blocking the things that needed to be done to give the Afghans a chance. Listening to Canestraro, Pillsbury assumed that the only thing McMahon and the agency really cared about was making sure they didn't get in trouble. It was in this climate that the final bureaucratic battle over the Stinger was waged. Mike Pillsbury had become so obsessed with this mission that he arranged for the entire 208 committee, accompanied by his conservative senators, to fly to Pakistan to lobby Zia to endorse the effort to deploy the Stinger. Zia had always insisted on personally approving each new weapon introduced into the jihad. 6 months earlier, Zia had told Senator Sam Nunn, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, that he had no objection to the Stinger. Gust had accompanied Nunn on this trip, but by then the agency had learned that Zia often played a double game with the Americans, saying one thing and then letting his intelligence chief take a different position. This time, with a delegation of senators present, Zia's green light had a major impact on the debate in Washington. Soon after that trip, Pillsbury's boss, Fred Ickle, persuaded the Joint Chiefs to drop their objections, and with that the CIA lifted its opposition. Now, even Secretary of State George Shultz joined the bandwagon, calling for the development of the Stinger as a means of quickly increasing the costs of the war to the Soviets. U.S. policy, he argued, should seek to persuade the new Communist Party boss, Mikhail Gorbachev, to cut his losses and get out before Afghanistan turned into Gorbachev's war. There was a green light from the National Security Council, a signature from President Reagan, and suddenly the ladies of Building 600 were assembling Stingers for the fundamentalist followers of Allah in Afghanistan. At least a half dozen officials claim major credit for this breakthrough, among them Pillsbury and Canestraro. Entire books are being written about this decision, based on the assumption that the fate of the Afghan war hinged on the decision to deploy the Stinger. Ironically, neither of Rakatos nor Wilson was directly involved in this decision and claims any credit. But in truth, Wilson had already fought and won this battle 2 years before when he'd forced the agency to break the color line and buy the Swiss Oerlikon. It was Charlie's Oerlikon victory that opened the door to the British blowpipe and the American Stinger. More important, now that the agency was running a covert war budgeted at over $750 million annually, no one could realistically argue that America's handprint, indeed its flag, was not all over this war. What Wilson had forced the agency and the White House to acknowledge was that if the Soviets hadn't already lashed out after the introduction into the war of more than $1 billion worth of weapons, it seemed safe to assume that they would not be shocked to discover that one of the weapons was made in the United States. Wilson was thrilled to learn of the Stinger decision, but not because he thought it would be decisive. At that point, no one had any idea just how devastatingly effective a weapon it would prove to be. "We figured the more shit we put in there, the better," remembers Wilson. "But we had already been disappointed by the SA-7s and the blowpipes, and when the PACs first tried out the Stingers, they didn't hit anything. We thought the Stinger was just adding another component to the lethal mix we were building." From Wilson's standpoint, the best thing about the Stinger decision was that, at last, no one was pretending anymore. According to Wilson, there still remained the question of whether Zia would be willing to deploy the Stinger, risking Soviet fury by removing this last fig leaf from the American secret war. At dinner in Islamabad that February, Charlie had taken advantage of his private session with Zia to bring up the Stinger question. By then, Wilson had come to think of Zia as almost a surrogate father, and Zia looked to Charlie as if he was one of his own trusted advisors. When Zia had confided that he was still uncertain about letting the Stingers into the jihad, Wilson had suggested that he should consider an important benefit beyond the weapon's battlefield value to the Mujahideen. The Stinger, he'd said, would become a symbol of the special relationship that had been forged between the United States and Pakistan. It would serve to identify the two countries as partners in the great battle against Soviet tyranny. It would further cement the bond between Zia and the Reagan administration, and in turn, Charlie had said, it would make it far easier for him to continue to increase U.S. military and economic assistance to Pakistan. Wilson had caught Zia's attention with this argument. The military dictator had already walked Pakistan way out on a limb by turning his country into the base camp for the Afghan jihad. There would have been no jihad without Zia, but without the massive U.S. military and economic assistance that had poured into Pakistan, the dictator would never have been able to justify the sacrifices he had forced upon his country. Pakistan had become the third largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid, and year after year, Charlie Wilson had been solely responsible for increasing that U.S. foreign assistance by tens of millions of dollars. Wilson's importance to Zia and Pakistan went beyond the extra money. Every year, the Appropriations Subcommittee members fought a battle royal over charges that Pakistan was actively pursuing an Islamic bomb. And every year, Wilson, sometimes single-handedly, beat back those accusations. The fact is, Pakistan was working on the bomb, as Wilson, the CIA, and almost everyone else knew. Furthermore, it was not about to stop. The one thing all serious Pakistani politicians agreed on was the need for a nuclear deterrent. It was the only way, they believed, they could survive against a militarily superior India, which had already overrun the country in 3 previous wars. Zia knew that as long as Pakistan was backing the Mujahideen, Charlie Wilson would be with them, whether they had the bomb or not. As usual, the kind of negotiation that Charlie had with Zia over dinner in February would have horrified the State Department. And, as usual, it worked. That night, when Wilson left Zia's residence, it was with a powerful sense of accomplishment. His idea had always been to bring America fully into the battle, and now that was going to happen. So, in the spring of 1986, the ladies of Rancho Cucamonga were unknowingly tasked by their country to become the armorers of a Muslim jihad. They were piecing together the delicate circuits and parts of an innocuous-looking weapon that would soon be revered by the holy warriors of Afghanistan as the most sacred of all instruments that Allah had placed in their hands. On each of the weapons cases given to the Afghans was a mysterious name, inscribed in black letters, General Dynamics. Few of the Mujahideen could read English, but all of them knew that Allah writes straight with crooked lines, and whatever the words might say, the silver bullet that had been given to them was a gift from God.